Welcome to Radio Free Deimos, an Ixun Draconis fan podcast broadcasting from ASAF Hall at Lake Voltaire on Deimos. Deimos, it's not just an asteroid. We also have disc golf. Tonight's episode is episode 10, The Cog Show, wherein your hosts demonstrate the vast depths of their ignorance on everybody's second favorite artificial life forms. But first, a look at Plate Mail Games' new Kickstarter, a few messages from Tumblr, and a non-definitive answer to the pressing question, are Kogsunes sentient? But first, let's get to know our hosts. Guys, if you could just give me your name and, in honor of our topic this week, what unnecessary attachment or accessory you'll be getting on your next upgrade. My name is Corbeau, and the unnecessary attachment I'll be getting this upgrade cycle is going to be a tablet mount, because I can't imagine what's more convenient than having that thing mounted 1 foot away from me at all times.
The audience will thank you.
I'm Wines, and my attachment would be having an explanation tattooed across my forehead as to why I'm worth female hyena's time.
That's good. That's good. I like that. That simplifies the entire conversation. You don't need to have a conversation at all at that
really
point.
Really important. Mm-hmm.
Most of the time, you wouldn't have a conversation with female hyenas anyway. So, my name's Ashtar, and the unnecessary attachment I would get would be fingertip smart surface interfaces. I'm tired of looking at these things. I just want to run my fingers down that glittery smart surface and have everything come alight.
Oh, so like input and output. You don't even look at all.
Exactly.
Nice. Okay.
Two-way interface.
Oh, and 3D.
Anything that big height for so long a time.
Yeah. I wonder what their next move will be.
For updates this week on the Radio Free Deimos webpage, we have none. That's simple. News from the Ixun Draconis universe has been a little bit light this year. They've wrapped up the Kickstarter, and that was the last big fanfare, and there's at least two books on the horizon. So this week, I'd like to take a quick look at Plate Mail Games' new Audio Loop Kickstarter. This is background tracks for the Numenera game. I don't know if you're familiar with Numenera, but it was the indie darling a few years ago, one of the biggest tabletop RPG Kickstarters everywhere. Numenera is a distant future, very strange, surreal, distant alien future setting. And these tracks, it's going to be 60 or so, 80 or so music loops, are good background music for this setting. So since it's alien science fiction, there's some natural, there's some strange, I think it's going to be good background music for Ixun Draconis as well. And I think the Kickstarter's worth a look. The Numenera game is written by Monty Cook, who back in the distant gaming dark ages of the mid-90s wrote the Planescape setting, very popular setting for Dungeons & Dragons. He's gone on to write a lot of really kind of experimental RPG settings since then.
Was he the one that wrote the Punch and Judy game?
No, that was my one true tabletop RPG love, whose name I can't remember. He wrote John Tynes, I think it was. It was John Tynes, I believe. But he wrote the Power Kill RPG, which is a thought experiment of, let's pretend your tabletop characters are actually psycho killers wandering through a tenement building.
Right, okay.
Not much of a stretch half the time.
Yeah. No. Wes Otis has done a number of audio loop Kickstarters in the past, and his work is very good abstract background noise. It's fun stuff and well worth a listen. Manimi, can you play a few seconds from The Beanstalk? That's one of the sample tracks on the Kickstarter. Thank you so much. Besides that, there's some new questions and answers about morphisms on the HSD Tumblr page. We will link to those in the show notes. This involves a fun time story about taking 1,000 followed vectors on a tour bus and a few words about the legacy memory morphism. These are two of the strangest morphism type mechanics in the game. And Pierce unpacks some of their social repercussions in these question and answer Tumblr posts.
We're going to take on the question of whether the second tail has to be in the same place this week.
It wouldn't be a tail if it wasn't.
Okay.
Ooh, wing tails.
Wag flap.
How can any race be so stupid?
Ah, don't ask me any questions. I'm just a hard hand just like you.
So we'll go on to questions and opinions, which is like questions and answers, but we don't really have answers. This week's question grew out of a discussion on the official HSD Discord channel, link in show notes. Are the Kagesunes sentient? And further, are the Radio Free Deimos hosts capable of defining sentience? I know, it's a hard one.
Yes and no. Next question, please.
Okay. So if we haven't touched on them, Kagesunes are artificial life forms. They're biotechnological critters that are, in my opinion, very much non-player character races. They're high-tech fennecs with detachable limbs that can do all sorts of very strange tricks. They have probably blaster hands and detachable robot mind control heads and extendable Inspector Gadget legs, what have you. Whatever strange techno toy you want, they have replaced one of their body parts with that.
Floor polishing tails.
Yeah, I'm going to hold on to this image for a while.
No, it's when they get stuck and the tail is stationary and the fennec is spinning around. That's
comedy gold. It's when you find the right spot on the fennec and all the limbs just pop off.
Oh, yeah, you rub their tummy and they kick so hard that they demodulate.
Well, I'd say in the distant future of HSD, the answer to whether Kagesune are sentient is, can they write a check?
In the modern world, we don't write checks anymore, so probably not.
Can they pay a bill? That's the question.
Most teenagers I know are non-sentient by that standard. And yeah. By many standards.
Yeah.
Still not arguing.
No, that's fine. So let's unpack the idea of what sentience means first, because I know a long, boring philosophical ramble is what everybody wants this time of day.
What's the argument against them being sentient?
They're dumb.
Okay.
Well,
But lions are considered sentient.
I know, and that's a great injustice. I understand this. I think the main reason you'd be concerned with why are Kagesunes sentient is because they are, in a sense, a slave class. They were created as happy workers for the ASR Corporation. And when another not so popular corporation tried to create a slave race, everybody got very upset with them. So the question is it ethical to have this cast of happy, happy worker robot foxes or not? So that's kind of where it comes down to is, are they sentient? Are they intelligent? Are they individuals? And therefore, can you keep them as slaves?
They spend their entire life doing what they love and they're not in my backyard. They're fine.
Well, they were programmed to do what they love. And then there's an ethical question there. Is that creating a slave race? We know that's bad.
If only we were all so lucky.
Approach it from a different direction. Can you interbreed with them? Or can vectors interbreed with them?
I'm sure they have an attachment for that.
Well, I'm sure they have attachment for that, but does it work?
Let me ask for affinity. One second.
We want an answer, not fan art.
I'll be back in a bit. Uh-huh.
Although we will take fan art, too.
Sure.
I don't know if the answer to whether Kagesunes can interbreed with vectors has been floated yet. My general idea is no, and here's how I'm going to back that up. Kagesunes are an alternate version of the biotechnology track. One can imagine them being kind of grown silicon organic life forms, kind of a meat technology that doesn't really match up very well with any other technologies. When this idea was being floated in Vector year 350 or so, they weren't able to add Kagesune type implants to existing vectors. They could only do that with somebody who had completely replaced their body with an inorganic version of itself. So it sounds like the silicon gel they're made from is not compatible with organic life as we understand it.
Now, just because they're not made in a man's image doesn't mean that they're not sentient.
Right. And I think that the question of what is sentience may be valuable here, although I think we all kind of are honing in on the same answer, which is that they're intelligent and therefore sentient.
Yeah. Well, another question would be, why is one asking the question, are they sentient? Is the question, can I buy and sell them? Is the question...
Well, yeah, I think the question is, can I buy and sell them?
Okay.
You can buy and sell vectors too, so...
Can you? I guess it depends where you are.
You might not have, you know, a bill of sale, but more or less, megacorps will buy and sell vector contracts all the time.
So the general definitions of sentience I've been able to find through Wikipedia, which I think is sentient by some definitions, the capacity to feel, perceive, or experience subjectively. Some Eastern philosophies say that sentience is a quality of empathy. It's the ability to experience suffering and therefore relate to other people through that shared experience. which is an interesting idea because in the text about Kagsunes, they really don't seem to mind pain that much. They are able to kill themselves as a transportation solution because they can kind of reappear elsewhere. So in a certain sense, maybe they can't empathize with people who have standard lives because they don't live that sort of pattern.
Mm-hmm. Certainly they look as vector-like as cogs do. In fact, they seem to look more vector-like than cogs do.
They've got like air intake ducts here and there across their body. They're a little more techno than a standard vector might be. And then there's the detachable limbs.
But they're identifiably like everyone else. I kind of feel, and this is coming at it from a fourth wall perspective, they're thrown in there for people that want to play robots. The idea of what a robot is, that you don't have the same attachment to your wetware that living things do.
Yeah, and I think they're kind of in the mage slot for me because they can do so many different things with their robotic attachments.
It's maybe yet another perspective on, are they sapient? Is that the term?
Sentient was the one I was going with. Sapient is technically a different idea. Sapience is wisdom.
Another take on are they sentient is, can I play one in a game? Or can I rationally play one in a game? And that has separate questions. It seems to say that they don't really fit too well.
Well, they fit perfectly well for the power gamer.
Right, right.
You can munchkin them into whatever you need.
And it justifies acting kind of asocial towards the rest of the party, right?
Yeah, you could say that.
So this really has warning signs all over it from a role-playing group perspective.
The real difference so far as a game mechanics perspective goes is that Kagsunes do not grow. They don't change. You get a character sheet and you're probably sticking with that character sheet. So they make more sense as one-shot characters in terms of a mission or recurring NPCs that have mastered a single idea or something like that. Some preeminent scholar might be a Kagsune, but they don't evolve, which is important in a character, in an NPC character.
Not always. There are definitely games that do not focus on character advancement or character development. Mm-hmm. If it's primarily a wargaming or militaristic contract-based tabletop game, then a Kagsune could fit in and give certain mechanical advantages that other PCs might not necessarily have, but doesn't really suffer any of the disadvantages of a Kagsune. If the game is more roleplay focused, development focused, or story focused, then the Kagsune would be less of an attraction or an interesting character and more of a kind of a drain on the table.
Or if somebody wants to play kind of a supporting character that just once per episode says, bloop, bleep, I do not understand what you're talking about. And everyone says, oh, robot character, you're so wacky. And then moves on. Some people, that's enough for a character, is just to have one joke, one line. And I could see how these little kitsune could fit that. That's not necessarily a bad thing. But I would just kind of worry that the sort of person that plays the thief that steals from the party, or the mad barbarian that simply attacks everyone that the D&D party meets,
it does not play well with others types.
Right. Does not play well with others. Well, in the hands of certain people. In the hands of certain other people, sure, it could work just fine. People that know what the limitations are and are willing to work with them, and also not try to turn the whole story to center around them.
So kind of a good, my main character's taking a vacation sort of character.
Sure.
One of the challenge scenarios for a group of Kagsune they talk about in the rulebook is that while a number of these critters working together can theoretically detach and levitate a mountain, no problem, they would really have a hard time going to the grocery store and dealing with the checkout lane. I kind of like that image.
So I think we basically came down to yes, sentient.
I think that by most definitions of sentient, they are sentient. They may not be the most empathetic creatures. They definitely think. They have individuality. They value their quirks. They enjoy pop music sometimes. And I think those are most of the major hallmarks of sentience. Although, I am wondering if whether the Kagsunes are or aren't sentient, I think that's not a question, really. There's some hints that the artificial intelligence that they are a part of might be. The rules talk about the Kagsune AI as being slightly different than the Kagsune. Maybe I'm misinterpreting, but I think that there's some evidence that maybe these are aspects of some larger intelligence. We do know that when Kagsunes die or fade out, they join the collective. So the idea of a racial hive mind sort of approach is not unheard of. Just a thought, kind of a scary thought.
Hmm. Yeah, again, I'm just feeling that we have the cogs, and it's totally reasonable that the cogs should just be people who happen to have robotic-like bodies, and that all of the things that a 21st century human wants to hang on robots has been swept over into this subclass of cyber kitsunes. So when you think classic 1950s Danger Will Robinson, don't think cog, think cyber kitsune.
Yeah, I still think that's a pretty reasonable summary. They are alien critters. They're much more technology than the cogs are in terms of the way they approach life.
Sure. And I can see people wanting to play a character who is genuinely an outsider. There's perfectly good reasons for that, which unfortunately cogs kind of aren't.
I think we'll be touching on that very much in a bit, but cogs very specifically are not.
Yeah, someone should do a podcast about that.
I do think eventually we're going to come back to Kogsunes as their own episode and talk about all their fun toys and some plot ideas for them. So I guess we'll drop this discussion. But general consensus is, yes, they are sentient. Yes, they are individuals. They probably aren't the best player characters. And I think that's what the rule books say as well.
We'll also come back to cute little outfits to dress them up in.
You know, having all those extra attachment points just vastly increases the breadth of outfit you can start designing.
True, true.
I have a series of wigs that plug into the back of my head.
This is the most fantastic story I've ever heard.
And every word of it's true, too.
So over the last week or two, we have restarted our tabletop HSD campaign after a 2-month hiatus for the holidays and some Mutants and Masterminds wackiness. So in as much as it's useful and it shows some of our interpretations of the HSD world, I'd like to violate my personal oath and my oath to my parents and talk about our characters for a bit and what happened over the last game.
Your ancestors feel shame. Yes.
I promise that is the case, but they're hairless dogs.
Such shame. That's why they tremble.
So when we last left our characters in the first plot arc, we broke some stuff, stole from Marsco, ran away from IRPF, melted a bunch of cop cars, and were fleeing the disaster we left behind to move to a quiet berth in an ASR dock on Phobos, which brought us into contact with a bunch of cogs, which, since none of us have read the cog section of the rulebooks until possibly this week, I thought was a really good reason to have this episode now.
And I like the example of how if you don't actually need to breathe oxygen or have oxygen around you, your space station can be a very, very different place.
We did have a depressurizing sequence. That was kind of fun.
Or two.
Yeah.
I mean, cogs are committed to the idea of living in orbit. Their stations might be more of jungle gyms or just truss that you bolt stuff onto.
Yeah, they give those hexapod ones some real advantages.
You don't get a lot of tourist trade that way, but you save a lot of money.
Well, and the example being used here is that the Greater Space Station was a much older station, and most of it was left exposed to hard vacuum. The actual living quarters at the heart was kept very, very minimal to vector life. It was just barely above the temperature that vectors can operate at, just barely above the atmosphere that vectors could operate at.
So if something went wrong, they might be able to survive. They wouldn't die, but they wouldn't be happy.
Right. But for the cogs, they were perfectly happy with that. That was well within their operation.
So the last major plot arc up to this point has been set on Phobos, which is a planetary dock/repair yard orbiting Mars. It's simultaneously the newest ship construction yards and built on 6 centuries or so of detritus and old buried tunnels and things like that. So it's a really great study in contrast in terms of architecture and legality. This station that we are in now, it has a variety of cogs that are not really represented in the rulebook so much. One of them, I think, was growing flowers on his chassis and was kind of studded with earth lumps and things like that, so he could grow a lovely bot garden.
Kind of a walking terrarium.
More specifically, was built into his chassis.
Okay.
The different terrarium parts were where muscle or empty space would be in unused space in a standard body. Mm-hmm. Strip out some of the fat, strip out some of the useless muscle, and just open that up as a little glass area that you're growing things in.
That's sweet.
The intention from the beginning was that this was not a group of standard cogs. It was very much a Temple of Misfit Toys type concept. Mm. So most of the cogs are very non-standard. And I did read up on that part of the cog. So this was intentional.
Sure. Yeah, the sure. China doll one was kind of a neat image and one that exists better in a low gravity, low impact space station.
Yeah, I like him.
So for the first time in a long time, we're also having the excitement of having a designated villain. That's been kind of a treat because we spent the last 3-episode plot arc being our own worst enemies.
Yes.
As we learned that our party is not capable of holding a heist. So now we're dealing with an assassin.
We have met the enemy and it is our own incompetence. Yes,
very much so. So now we're dealing with an assassin and possibly an upcoming dungeon crawl, which is... After a very open-ended plot arc, is kind of nice to have the friendly recess into a more 1975-style RPG session. I could be wrong. Ashtar's giving me a you-don't-know-what-you're-talking-about expression.
It is always interesting to see what the players will put together with the clues they're laid in their path.
Well, since your captain has a background with Pulse, the ineptitude will be televised.
I think that's the summary of our campaign characters as well.
Yeah. We're a
broadcasting company in some ways. Okay, so the latest plot arc has been escape from the crowded portion of the mostly abandoned space station, move to the vacant section of the mostly abandoned space station, and find the assassin that's been living in this part of the station for the last 10 years and get shot by him.
Because remember, players, owning a spaceship means whenever the GM writes up stories for a certain area, you can always leave and go somewhere else.
You can. This enters the negotiation phase again. The other interesting tidbit was discovering the various interactions of shrapnel grenades, minimal spacesuits, and hard vacuum.
Yeah, it's presumably the reason that the suck suits are called suck suits.
We've received messages from their spaceships. For a while, it came in as just a lot of jumbled noise.
So on to the topic for the day, which is cogs.
Cog, of course, is an acronym for catfish on the grill.
No, that would be cod.
Oh.
Cogs are an acronym for cognizant and conscious machine, because ASR really likes acronyms. In fact, all engineers really like acronyms.
Even when they don't make sense.
That's true. That would actually be... I'd have to bleep myself if I say what that would be.
TLAs.
Okay, so cogs were initially created as an ally race for the Vectors. To look at their full story, we'd have to go back to about 70 years after the fall of man, more or less same time period as the third generation of Vectors are being developed. Vectors are artificial life forms, it's worth pointing out. They are test tube creations designed more or less on a human framework. And so they're comfortable with the idea of being a created thing. So for applied science and technology to create a new race, it wasn't entirely out of the question. First, some philosophical themes about the world of cogs, which I think will help kind of unpack them as ideas. One of the central themes that HSD comes back to again and again with the cogs is that they are not...
They're not computers.
Well, no, they're not computers. They're not tools. The text... So if I say this, Ashtar's going to laugh at me. The general philosophy is being a machine does not make you a tool. He's smirking at me. So the way this is implemented is they tend to steer away from task-oriented implants they back away from things that would let them be more efficient at their jobs because they're not a shovel. They're a human. Well, they're a creature. They're a living creature. So whereas a Vector photographer journalist might replace their eye with a camera, that's something a cog would never do. They don't tend to deal with biotechnology very well. They don't like implants. Even in terms of the bodies they develop for themselves, they tend to steer away from utilitarian forms. So they're not going to have a broad, hardworking, bulky frame. They're probably not going to cover themselves with armor because those are tasks and tools, not living creatures.
Just as an aside, it's totally the opposite premise of the very first science fiction story that described robots, RUR, in which is this person was trying to figure out robots' psychological problems that they had, which were best solved by getting, in this story, all robots were copies of humans. but the robots were made happier by removing everything which was not actually relevant to their job. Once their bodies were pared down to the bare minimum, they were psychologically much happier with the universe. That's totally the opposite direction that these guys are going.
Yeah, very much so. That's like a devolution, whereas the Cog story is not one of drawing closer to humanity or the vectors, because they're already that kind of life form.
And when you say life form, the brain of a Cog is almost specifically not a robot. It's not necessarily a programming language, a set of instructions. It is an experience engine. It soaks in experiences and maps them together, much like a brain does. Once you get beyond that, it makes a point of saying that this isn't something that you can open up and look at the code. That is their soul.
Sure. Are they actually cyborgs and not robots?
No, they're totally artificial life. There's nothing about them that maps exactly onto organic.
Well, under the shell, are they mechanical parts or are they living things?
That question loses a bit of usefulness when the vectors can replace most of their body with cybernetics as well.
Well, let me rephrase that. Under the shell, are they meat?
No.
Or are they parts?
They're parts.
Electronic parts. Okay.
They have a reactor.
Okay.
Yeah.
A standard Cog frame is going to be fully mechanical.
Okay.
Yeah, most of the art in the book kind of shows very robotic stylings on them. The more expensive and therefore kind of the chassis you get when you grow up might have a flexible face that can mimic a frown or smiles and has like softer, gentler curves. But they are robots. They look robotic.
Okay. And they're not like lobsters.
Well, at the same time, there were several joke attempts and jokes made about fleshware, as it were. And that did not work out very well. And it was made a point of that for the most part, Cogkind and ASR in general has abandoned that concept. Cogs generally pick frames that are intentionally looking different from vectors, and they prefer it that way.
Sure. Rather than being an imperfect copy.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Early on, there were furry bodies for the Cogs, and that just never really caught on. It just kind of looked creepy. Like Teddy Ruxpin. Are you my friend?
At the same time, it has been how many hundreds of years since then? Technology keeps getting better.
Yeah. And also, what better to do as a rebellious Cog teen than dress yourself up in fake skin? Wouldn't that piss off your elders?
So that kind of brings us another philosophical element. Cogs actually don't tend to change that much over generations. There's some technological advancement in the chassis, like they have that one body that's got the flow form water-based tentacle apparatus that looks like something out of that old movie, The Abyss.
There are no Goo Girls in HSD. But you have the closest thing in Cogs.
Huh.
Presumably we're going to link to the concept of Goo Girls in the show notes. I think Ashtar just spoke over my head.
Or not.
Or not. But fundamentally, the architecture, the brain central unit of the Cog has not changed over many, many centuries. That's pretty stable. That's pretty much the same. They are the same creatures they've always been. And that was a major point of conflict when the Kagsune life form was created, because there was some question of whether applied scientific technology was going to take that as the new direction and just discard this race they'd created. But no, much like humans, they haven't evolved that much physically over time. Well, you can't say the same thing about vectors.
There are a couple of points in HSD that have the same, something is done once, done right the first time, and never touched since. And Cogs do kind of fall under that.
Well, so you're talking about like them not changing over time. Does that mean that you can kind of, if you see a Cog and it's a tar wolf robot thing, that its parents look like that too, and that their parents look like that also? I mean, the recognizable physical lines?
Yes-ish.
And no.
Mostly yes. I think we'll probably talk a little about that when we talk about the birds and the bots later on. But a baby Cog will tend to look like its parents when it's born. And while it can change its body over time, and will over the course of the first 20 years of its life, it's going to figure out what its soul is and its body is going to reflect that. They don't tend to evolve that much away from their base frame, their beginning default chassis, because when they were born, that reflected who they are. And that doesn't tend to change that much over the years.
So there's a couple of concepts that are introduced here. Cogs being born, cogs growing up, and cogs changing. It is useful at this point to point out that while a cog will not necessarily change their frame often, it is culturally and very intentionally structured that as a cog develops, generally through the first 20 years of their life or so, there are certain checkpoints where ASR will offer them the next evolution of frame. So you will start with a very tiny frame, kind of a baby-sized frame. About 3 years, you might move to a toddler frame. And then every 2 or 3 years after that, you go back to ASR, you pick, flip through the catalog and choose the next frame that you feel matches your personality. Cogs will usually use these to do some of that teenage rebellious you were talking about. But generally about the point that you hit, a cog would hit 20 or so, that cog would probably settle into a frame that the cog would probably have tested half a dozen different frames and would settle into what they feel is most them, their expression of themselves.
And they can use a simulator to try on different ideas. Maybe I want to experience what it's like to be a wheeled six-legged thing or what have you, but they tend towards minor variations in their various iterations of themselves and not too many radical changes, though there's almost always the wheel phase somewhere in the mid-adolescence. That's an inevitable one. I feel like the big change is going to be around age 50 or so. The midlife crisis bot.
the red Corvette bot.
Yeah, absolutely.
So even though they're not really defined understandably in the book, one should imagine that there are certain identifiable lines, that there's the wheeled tar, and the people have certain preconceptions about them because a certain sort of person chooses those bodies, and then there's this other body, and they have their own reputation. People pick that body because blah, kind of like a social identity is what I'm hearing.
I think you could assume a little of that. The child when two cogs have a child unit, it's drawing from both of the parents' psychologies, preferences, and body types. And if those two cogs identify as fox bots, then their kid is going to have fox-like traits. The child inherits many things from their parent, and their body and their mind reflects that when they're born. So chances are, if two cogs have the tentacle-style bodies, there's some really great imagery there, but when they have their kid after that imagery, that child is probably going to have tentacles. Maybe not, it's not guaranteed. There's a certain level of Lamarckian evolution in these beasts. I think that since the child picks up mom and dad's preferences when they're born, if mom really likes roller derby, there's a chance Junior will be born with wheels.
Okay.
I can't rule it out. I may be overstating, but there's a little of that element in there. The things that the parents like and appreciate are reflected in the child as well.
And these bodies are not being built by ASR or anyone else, right? They're all grown from little cogs.
No, they're definitely manufactured.
Oh, they're still manufacturing them. Okay.
ASR would have a catalog of whatever, and you can print out the frame.
Now, the first one is naturally created. It's made from ASR's strange alternate version of genetics.
And then ultimately set aside and recycled?
In 2 years, yeah. 2 or 3 years, they're going to switch out of their first bot body and into some new one, which is probably loosely based on the first one.
As I said, made by ASR.
Well, the second one is the first body is not made by ASR. The thing that they're initially placed in is it's hatched from an egg, and that egg came out of a mommy robot.
When daddy and mommy love each other very much, they license ASR.
This is Junior patent pending.
But so I'm just imagining that we might have, I mean, okay, so cog one grows up to age two, decides he wants a new body. Can you pass on that new body? Some other parents say, hey, our kid would like that old body. That looks just great for him.
Probably not. And I think, for one thing, this society assumes that you're going back to ASR. There's a certain level of indentured servitude-ness in this. That's probably a harsh way of saying it. But ASR does like their cogs to be somewhat dependent on them. And that's why they provide these things for free. And these things are... it's probably the one thing in all of Ixun Draconis that is provided for free.
So almost no adult cogs have born bodies, it sounds like.
No one would be born into their adult form. I mean, they physically grow, too.
Okay.
That'd be a really rough egg birth otherwise.
interesting. No, it's just an interesting concept that your born form is inevitably going to be discarded and recycled. This is also reminding me, have you read the is it Anne McCaffrey story, The Ship Who Sang?
I think we've referenced it 27 times.
Oh, we have?
And it's only episode 10. But go on.
Well, it's relevant. Just in that world, there's the occasional person born with some sort of horrible defect, and they're raised as cyborgs. They just flush the body and put the brain in a robot body, and they're raised that way. The reference in the name of the book, The Ship Who Sang, is that the top of the class get to be brains that control starships. It's very expensive growing up this way, so by the time you're an adult, you owe the corporation that brought you up a lot. You'll be working with them for many, 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 many years, being part of a spaceship or other large device, being its controlling intelligence. But I'm just hearing a lot of similarities here.
So that would be a callback to, I think, episode 3 or so, where our questions and opinions, this is one of our first ones, was would a cog choose to be the soul of a spaceship? Rules as written, culture as written, the answer is definitely no, because that would be an extreme expression of the idea of cog as tool, and that is really antithetical to the entire race. Your individuals may vary.
Right. Of course, player characters always play special snowflakes.
Absolutely.
That's not a bad thing.
No.
Just don't look at the player characters as an example of a sane universe.
No. So I want to come to... So... I'd really like to spend some time right this second talking about the life cycle of the cog, the different chassis and things like that. But what you just said brings up one of the other important philosophical points of cogness, which is that they are by far more natural than vectors. They are inorganic constructs, but the comparison that's made several times throughout the text is that vectors are much more unnatural in their behavior than these cogs are. Depending on how you define the word natural, scare quotes. One example of that is, in their birth, which we were discussing, and their early childhood, vectors tend to put their kids in learning vats, speed growthy things, pods for the first 6 months, 8 months of their lives. And that kind of gets rid of the whole awkward childhood thing. Whereas the books don't specifically address cog infancy, but it says that they're organic, they go to school, they learn by learning. I think that the vector childhood is specifically set up as being somewhat dystopian, whereas we don't get that picture of the cogs. Their end of life is kind of the same. The end of life for vectors is really determined by the whim of the corporations. Vectors can live to be 100 or more, and during most of that life, their bodies are robust and young and tended to by pulse treatments, but those treatments end at the last 10 years of their lives. They tend to go off the treatments and have a frantic period of bucket list wish fulfillment that's incredibly profit to the corporations, and then they die. Whereas cogs just fade into a dreamy, fairly creative twilight and then eventually transcend. It's much more idyllic and definitely less frantic than the vectors are. And this comes up several times. They simply are more natural in the way they approach the world. I think natural as we would have understood it in a different century, really, than the vectors are. The vectors are very gung-ho about progress and change. Their bodies are tapestries. They can rewrite them as they see fit. Cogs don't. They keep their bodies.
They're more socially organic.
Yeah.
I used a phrase earlier very intentionally, and that was made in man's image. Both vectors and cogs are very much made in man's image, at least one side of it, which is a theme that runs through HSD. But you can contrast that very starkly against some of the other intelligences that inhabit HSD. The two named that are created, and then the couple of others that are hinted and floating around.
That kind of reminds me of the World Tree role-playing game where the 7 or 8 different sentient races were really different ideas of life and culture and society.
But I think it is worth kind of driving home that anyone that goes into HSD wanting to play a cog because they want to play the sci-fi 70s, 80s robot is not going to be playing a successful cog. Cogs really should be played almost more human than the vectors running around.
Yeah, definitely less neophilic crazy. I think you could...
It would be kind of funny to be the one cog that light going bleep bloop, I do not understand pop culture references, who's then shunned by all the rest of his kind. It's like, oh my God, it's one of those. He has flashing lights on his forehead. Honey, let's just leave.
I believe that the current campaign has landed in a nest of those.
Oh dear. Well, at least looking like a piece of modern art is not the same thing as looking like a sci-fi trope robot.
That is true.
It seems like while cogs tend to have vaguely vector-shaped bodies and things like that, that tends to happen most often when they are in societies that are integrated with vectors. And when they're off on their own, when they're on like an ASR installation on Ganymede or something like that, things may get a little bit stranger. When talking about gender, the books say that identifying as male or female is one of the first things to go when cogs are out of a shared species environment. So some of that is maybe developed in relation to vectors as a part of the give and take of cultures. They don't have to do that, though, and some of them do have much more robotic looks. If the art in the book is any guideline, some of those are very robotic.
Well, one of the themes for cogs throughout inception to present day has always been integration. You'll see that word pop up several times in the book discussing cogs and vector society. And in a certain light, cogs were really created as the first friendship race for vectors. So there is a certain amount of cultural reflectiveness or cultural almost stabilization force that they do provide.
Thinking in terms of integration and looking back at the racial makeup and struggles of the United States, one of the places where African-Americans made strong inroads into white-dominated culture was the field of sports, which ironically is the one place where cogs cannot make any progress at all, because sports are dominated by Pulse, and that's the enemy corporation of ASR. They're not welcome in the games because they're robots.
They don't get to play robot ball?
They get to play robot ball, but Giant Robot Ball was developed by ASR as a response to Pulse.
Okay.
There aren't integrated sports events much. We need to have an episode on sports just to touch on this.
At the same time, you're average minor league Pulse athlete so far exceeds the standard operating parameters of a cog frame that cogs just would not compete. Huh.
I think it's a great segue to the character sheet stuff, which I'd like to look at next. Cogs are, for the most part, better than you. There's no way around that.
Oh, so they're a good power gamer choice?
I wouldn't say that, but they're definitely plus one.
Okay. But they can't get all those cool surgeries, right?
No, generally not. They'd handle that through upgrades and such like. Again, with the guiding rule of let's not make our bodies into tools.
Well, not all of the cool surgeries, but they have some.
They can get transcendent implants. We don't talk about that. That's a hidden... What are you thinking of?
That's what I'm thinking of.
I assure you, I am fully functional in every way.
God. What's it called? The large characters?
Macro.
There's no way to do that with a cog, right?
I haven't seen it.
So, rules as written, the ASR frame catalog does not include a macro frame. Uh-huh. Obviously, technology could create such a thing. If we're again talking rules as written and in game, that would probably be a cog creating their own frame.
Sure.
Well, so the way this is addressed in the books is the various chassis that are developed by ASR are the standard ones that are in the book. That's rules as written. You can go off market. You can get a chassis that's made by some crazy mad scientist, independent researcher on Ganymede. But ASR kind of frowns upon that because it takes away from their ownership of the cogs. And the cost is ridiculous because you're dealing with artisanal workmanship. So there are strange lambent glow-in-the-dark laser frames and hollow frames and things like that, but they are not part of the ASR catalog. They're much more expensive, and people will look at you and know that you have kind of violated your social contract with ASR on some level. Right,
because it doesn't have the built-in ASR monitoring software. I mean, warranty.
At the same time, the vector could do much the same. If they really wanted to regraft their arm with a, I don't know.
Chainsaw.
There are plenty of ways to do that. They're expensive, but bio chainsaw arms, someone's selling it somewhere.
Sure, sure.
Well, and vectors have no problem with adding chainsaws to their body if they really want to. A vector's body is also a tool for self-expression at a high cost, but they're much more liberal with what you can do. You can turn yourself into organic goo as a vector if you choose to. It's expensive. You can have your brain replaced with all sorts of fun augmentations, which my character has done. You can do all sorts of things to your body as a tapestry that cogs wouldn't do because their body reflects their soul.
Well, in general, in bulk, yes. But you have body purity vectors and you'll have far more body expressive cogs as well.
Yeah. And again, we're just drawing broad generalities here.
As an aside, I love thinking there's a 1950s short sci-fi story. In this universe, all the bikers would have their teeth replaced with interlocking gears that would spin when they talked, making it very hard to understand anything they said. But cool.
I see no problem with this.
Yeah.
All right, let me try it.
Until your lip gets stuck in it.
So, the character sheet stuff. First off, the single biggest perk that being a cog gives you is you have computer tech. You have computer telepathy. This is something that all of my characters would like to have at some point in time. By being near a computer, a cog can drift through its hard drives and explore its interior space really close to as easily as they can their own heads.
I dream in binary sheep.
Yes, along those general lines. What they cannot do is hack. They can't delete a file. They can't turn on a computer, but they can exist in its storage space, basically.
Well, what about feline-shaped cogs? Can they hack? Sorry, go ahead.
Which is an interesting constraint in that the wireless language or the mental electronic telepathy language does not contain those verbs somehow, and that is a very artificial constraint. Standard interfacing with the computer absolutely allows such commands. So is it just so culturally taboo that no cog ever thinks to try it? Or is it not part of the protocol and no one's ever thought to hack it in? Or is it literally part of the programming that a cog does not quote unquote have that prevents them from doing such a thing?
It's the last one. Philosophically, it's kind of like the way their brain can drift away into thought space at the end of their lives. But in practice, it's intentional game balance on the part of ASR to make sure that this group of creatures cannot dominate the world by plugging directly into computers and flipping switches with their brains. It's intentional limitation. If a cog wants to do this, they have to use the standard hacking rules. But it is definitely a choice on the part of ASR to limit them. Can they bypass that? Certainly your campaign's big nemesis NPC can. Okay, so more character sheet stuff. They are more resilient than vectors. They have +1 body resilience, but every race has +1 to some stat. That's just part of character creation. They have a free point of allegiance to ASR, which is one more point of allegiance than most other races have. It can't go up to 3, though. They have +1 computers, but every race has 1 extra skill, so that's nothing out of the place. They can use transcendent implants. That's not really a character sheet thing. It's not really discussed either. That's kind of, we don't talk about that material. And I think the reason for that is that TTI prides itself on being a biotech firm and not a tech firm, so they just don't want to admit that this compatibility exists. And that also raises some questions about what is life on a very basic and cellular level, but I don't think we have the time to get into that right now. Their healing rules are different. They substitute patch kits and robotics for medicine and perks. And they have some we don't breathe environmental resistance things that make them much more resilient in the hazards of space than a vector ever would be. They can survive temperature extremes from like -40 Fahrenheit to 176 Fahrenheit with no real discomfort. And then you start using the extreme temperature rules. They can hold their breath in space for 8 minutes. They do eventually need to breathe because the oxygen powers their internal reactor somehow. But by and large, they have much more leeway when it comes to breathing, drowning, all those kind of moment by moment maintenance things that living creatures have. One thing they don't get that most vectors get is morphism triggers. So
momentum triggers.
Momentum triggers, my bad. So a digitigrade fox would have a mechanic that if they can successfully in combat make 2 attacks in a row, one of those, then they can be vastly more effective in combat for the next few rounds. There's a lot of things like that that are tied to your unique body shape and configuration. Cogs have abilities that are granted by their chassis, like if they have the levitating chassis, then they have a lot of movement and magnetism-related abilities, but they don't specifically have the morphism triggers.
Momentum triggers.
Momentum triggers. I'll never get it. Never, never, never. One huge thing they have, which I think is something we've house-ruled, but is not specifically stated in the books, is that since they have a very buddy-buddy relationship with ASR, and since their bodies are expressions of themselves, they can start the game, start character creation in debt to ASR, but get enhancements, surgery-type things, implants and augments, again, within the philosophical constraints of it's not a tool, but they can begin the campaign with a level of customization that rules as written most vectors could never have. And they have to pay for that over the course of the game, but it's a pretty generous perk that even a hardcore by-the-books game master can't work around.
That one is written into the book. That is specifically for cogs. The house rule that we had was that other vectors were allowed a light amount of debt for customizations that really just would not fit with the character coming in after the game starts.
Yeah, that's been one of my kind of ongoing hurdles with HSD and other games where you start at zero level, which is that there are some powers and abilities that are character defining, and you want to at least have a taste of them at character creation, or you're not really the character that you see. Cogs don't have that problem to the same degree. They can begin the game as, in many ways, as they see themselves in a few years. But it's on credit, and that ties them to ASR in a property way that you wouldn't necessarily have with a starting level vector.
Repo Man.
Moving on to the birds and the bots, cog facts of life. I have learned more about cog reproduction than I would ever have chosen to. So, when a mommy cog and a daddy cog love each other very much and give each other a special hug, the mommy cog has a pregnancy period and eventually lays an egg. That egg hatches into a cog that reflects the minds and bodies and moods of the parents, and to some degree, perhaps their wishes for their child. It's kind of hazy as to what the quote DNA unquote of a baby cog is. It's as much cerebral as it is physical.
So you're saying if you're a cog and work in a call center and want everyone to die, don't reproduce?
Yeah, that seems fair. Okay. You may get an unusually angry child if you're spending your life being angry.
Just imagine murder bot.
But the mental traits of the parents do drift down into the child. Presumably, if both parents had a profound love of chocolate, that would manifest in the child, that sort of thing.
Really wishing it could actually eat chocolate.
They can eat chocolate.
Okay.
They can identify many pleasant molecules in the chocolate structure. The first rule book, the main rule book, which is a little bit more ha-ha funny in places than the follow-up rule book, talks a little about cogs reproducing with wombs. And in fact, they can and do. Joking aside, that the womb is kind of maybe a side unit or an internal unit. I don't know which. Whatever the world needs.
Small trailer.
Beep, beep, beep. And that womb lets a female cog reproduce with a male vector if they so choose. And when this happens, when a vector and a cog reproduce together, the womb unit analyzes the psychology and biology of the cog parent and the physical makeup of the vector parent and creates something that's a harmonious blend of the two. Usually, if a female cog has a child by a male vector, that child is going to be a cog because female cogs can give birth only to artificial lives, life forms. If the cog parent is the male partner, and this kind of parallels the way egg laying hops around vector families, if the male parent is the vector, then the child may be a cog and it may be a vector, 50-50 on that one. Though it usually picks up the species of the mom, unless the daddy is a cog that identifies with another species. Let's say he is a horse bot or something like that in his heart and, you know, has pictures of horses all over his cubicle and a cutie mark. if the father has a species they've registered as, then the child may take after the father's species. Again, it's a coin flip as to what happens and how.
It's like a name drop in 1970s sci-fi horror film called Demon Seed. Look it up yourself.
Provide the trailer in the show notes.
Sure.
The important thing to note is Cog or Vector, they're entirely uninteresting for the first 16 years or so until they're old enough to hold a gun and go on contracts.
Yeah, very few tables roleplay someone from birth to late adolescence. Again, talking about the general life cycle of the Cog, they have a number of chassis that are given to them by ASR over the course of the first 20-ish years of their life. Early on, they have a free chassis at age 2, 4, 6, 9, 12, or something like that. It goes up to every 3 years after a certain point. During adolescence, they become able to reproduce should they choose to, which has even more strange chassis attachment points. And by age 20, they've got their final body, one that they'll stick with for 20 or 30 years until such time as they purchase one out of pocket that meets what they've become at that point in their lives. As they grow, as they change chassis, they get just about enough time with their body to learn it, and then they get swapped into a new one. So in many ways, the childhood experience of being a cog is one of continually learning your body and continually having it evolve faster than you do, which is, I think, analogous to how we experience life ourselves.
I'm just imagining parents keeping around the body you are born in bronzed. Wouldn't that be fun?
You know, I can't rule that out. That makes sense to me. I don't know if they go bad or not, but sure, let's put Junior's first head in the cupboard.
Oh, honey, remember when that was you? You were cute back then.
We made it ourselves.
Growing up as a cog, the books don't address everything about the early years of a baby cog's life. But if you go to the HSD Discord chat, you can regularly find the author there who will cheerfully answer questions if you press him nicely. And I asked a little bit about what cog infancy is like. This is one of those places where you have the more natural than vectors thing strongly underlined. In vector society, it's generally done to have your first 6 months or so, maybe to a year, written off. Your company will pay for pod growth acceleration and Neuroplex learning modules and things like that. So when you get your child back after the first year of their life, they've gotten over that whole squalling and messing their diapers stage.
Society itself will pay to get your kid past its terrible twos.
Yes. Yeah. That's a fair summary. And a lot of that is if you happen to be a more valuable employee, then you don't have to experience those terrible twos in quite the same way as the poor people do. And that's nice. It's one of the perks. The growing period of a cog is, it doesn't have that artificial flavor to it. The cog infant, it's not fully functional. It doesn't, as far as I know, it doesn't talk, but it dreams and sleeps and runs simulations on itself and has a lot of the sort of helpless downtime that you would have with an infant before they start really aggressively exploring the world. They're not active and alert and aware, but they are developing, they are processing, and they are not squalling. And presumably they do not need to have their nappies changed because that is not how cogs work. You get rid of the whole evil infant Winston Churchill thing, and the first year or so of cog life is fairly peaceful and fairly tranquil and does not involve vet learning tube tubs, as far as we know.
So this would be a society in which the only model for very, very young people are robots, because you don't get to see anyone else be ages, what?
I think you just
1 through 5 in our world, the equivalent of that.
I think you only really lose the first, say, year of your life to vets if you're a vector.
Okay.
And presumably, if you're on Ganymede or one of the more hard scrabble colonies.
Rustic.
Yeah. Or there's going to be pockets of people that avoid the neuroplexing. I think that it only is the first year of your life that you lose to the tubs and the tubes. And after that, you're a very young child, but you're probably starting at crawling age. And I think it's hinted that vectors develop a little more rapidly than humans anyway. Mm-hmm. So there are children, there are little cubs and things like that. And they go to school, which is mostly a mixture of classroom and a little bit of neuroplexing. And time and again, the cog description says that cogs learn by learning. They learn by going to school. They learn by socially interacting. So they are right there in the classroom with the vectors, one assumes, growing like children and experiencing the world like children. They have the same rebellious period that you get with vectors in the adolescent ages, once they hit their adulthood, they're going to be staying in their final bodies, which are the ones they're going to be investing money in for the extra features for the next 20 or 30 years. And at some point late in their lives, in the maybe age 60s, maybe age 70s, it varies by the individual, they start to get a little bit spacier, a little more mystic, a little bit more trancy, a little bit more artistic as their mind tends to go on longer dreaming runs. Over the last X years of their life, let's say 10, they fade out more and more, and eventually they are uplifted mentally into what I've referred to several times as the great thumb drive in the sky, the shared afterlife of the cogs, where we don't know what they're experiencing, what their intelligences have transcended into, but it's probably pretty nice.
Black Mirror suggests that we're experiencing the 80s over and over again.
And that's another place where I think that the life of the cog is more human than Vector's are, in this kind of blissful fade out, which is maybe not how the real world works, but it is how some storybooks endings might work.
Whereas the Matrix says it's not a very nice place at all, because the utopia kept crashing.
In fact, there are only two people that know what it's like at all, because there are two gatekeepers employed by ASR to watch over the cog afterlife. Presumably they have the thumb drive in their back pocket. I don't know. So I have a theory that the hive mind that is the Cogzunes either has infiltrated or is in fact the cog afterlife, but I can't prove this in court. It's just the way my campaign is going to run when I run this game.
Okay. I'll make a note and make sure I forget that. Done.
What?
Yeah.
So as they grow from age 2 to 20, the cogs change their bodies a number of times, like 9 or 10 or so. And each time they're picking something that reflects themselves. And it's a very slow development over time, minor variations. They don't tend to choose wildly inappropriate, dramatically changing body types. The PCs probably do. Though they do tend to have a phase where they adopt wheels at some point in time. That's when it's inevitable. It's generally seen if a cog radically changes their body, there's something kind of wrong with them. I think you could kind of draw a parallel to like changing your religion or saying, "Mom and Dad, I'm a furry," something like that. It's considered flighty and out of character for a cog to change dramatically and suddenly.
And thus totally on the table for adolescence.
Absolutely. But they tend to change back too. They'll experiment with a new body and then swap back after 2 years.
"Mom, is there anything you'd hate it for me to do?" It's like, "No, hon, anything is fine. Even if you decide to be a floating robot." Oh, crap. Floating robot, yes.
Flowform tentacle pod.
"Son, I told you you'd have to leave the house if you weren't bound by gravity." So for cogs, death is a feature. It's part of the life cycle that makes life valuable. And again, more human than Vector's. The section on life and death in Ixun Draconis Extended has the single most cynical statement I've found in the entire book series so far, talking about how Vectors live and die. Vectors have a life of about 90 years or so. When they want to start living purely for the sake of living, rather than for the sake of continued contribution to the economy or to scientific community, they have stopped being an asset to the corporation they live in. If anything, they become a drain. That's on page 56. They talk a little later on about how during the last 10 years of a Vector's life, when he's desperately trying to reach every item on his bucket list, he becomes fabulously profitable. And the corporations find death to be a good moneymaker. It's dark there. It's really dark. There's some really fun little throwaway lines in the cog description that just illuminate the rest of society. Other minutiae of cog life. Do cogs need oxygen? Yes and no. They don't have to breathe like Vectors do, but they are tied to air as a part of their power and cooling system. So they can go for 10 or 8 minutes or so in open space before starting to shut down.
Or just screw in a tank for longer?
Presumably, yes. Do they eat? Not really. They move stuff around their plates with forks. They drink a lot. They drink as much as any Vector would eat and drink together. And they like a variety of liquids. Presumably, they like a nice shot glass of motor oil once in a while. Acids, anything that splashes around, they can ingest, and their internal processes take it apart, isolate the vital nutrients, and make some use of it for their ongoing metabolisms.
Mercury. Mm-hmm. I'll wash those glasses really well.
But they do say that your first experience eating with a cog is a very strange one indeed. They don't really taste like vectors do. Rewind that one. They don't experience taste the same way vectors do, but they can chemically analyze things and take apart the molecules and say, oh, this has much more trisodium glutamate than that did, and presumably derive some sort of entertainment from that.
Like, oh, it looks like that would be great to mush up and then shove it into an orifice.
Yes.
Monosodium glutamate? That gets my pleasure centers firing.
So I wonder if there's room for a plot of secretly getting rid of toxic waste by serving it to cogs.
I think they've got other answers for dealing with it. They can shoot anything into the sun they want to.
Yeah, but...
I mean, it's funny.
You're good for mustache twirling.
Cogs have a number of body types that kind of roughly mimic vector morphisms. Broadly speaking, their shape and outline. They come in the standard bipedal version, which is what most of them take that shape, actually. There's the anime drifting, barely touching the surface maglev version, which is a very take it or leave it approach to inertia. And then following that, there's the tentacled version, very, again, anime. Great climbers, kind of large. That's actually closer to the macro size than most other ones are. They're pretty massive.
Okay.
The six-legged hexapod shape. Can I say spider tars now?
No.
Okay. The six-legged hexapod shape, which has kind of a vaguely insectile look. Again, great climbers. Wheels. Yeah, that's most of them. It's a short list. But further, they can choose to specialize to emphasize a certain thing that they find interesting, which, again, is not being a tool. This is rather a fussy difference, though. A maglev version may be powered for thrust and speed, may have magnetic hard locks. The tentacled version may have wacky gecko feet that let them climb, or paddle-shaped tentacles for swimming.
Or be made out of water.
Or be made out of flow-form water tentacles, which is pretty awesome. And again, please see The Abyss. It was a great movie. The hexapod one may have more like a tar build that a vector might have, which is greater, better for speed and, you know, straight line running. The wheeled version may have tank treads or all-terrain suspension or motorcycle-like narrow configuration. There are several pages of tailored, customized body types that make for great artwork. And the range of bodies that a cog can choose from is vast. In practice, most of them are happy being humanoids, though.
And mechanically, each of the different types has different advantages and disadvantages, which do have gameplay mechanics. So this really picks up and replaces a decent amount of the morphism specializations that a vector would have.
And the surgery options as well. A lot of the advantages that you can pay for with cash, for one thing, a cog never would. They don't develop like that. They don't choose to develop like that. But a lot of those are filled in by the rules for specialized body frames.
From a game balance perspective, the cog probably has more options and more powerful options in the beginning, whereas vectors can definitely develop into many more options as the game works through.
Which is probably one of the reasons why the more exotic body types are referred to as specializing rather than just a fresh chassis. It's something they might choose to grow into as they decide who they are as a person involves tank treads. I've always thought that my future and my soul involve tank treads.
Is there any such thing as a lateral cog?
No.
Under the established frames, there isn't anything that closely matches. Uh-huh. In fact, most of the established frames are generally waist down. It's almost assumed that the torso and head, arms...
are always...
is fairly standardized.
Vectoroid.
Well, it's not hard-coded. For example, the tentacle frame often will have the tentacles as arms as well. But most of the frames deal more with motion, movement, that type of thing. Uh-huh.
I think if you wanted a purely animal-shaped form, I guess that would be a legitimate vehicle for self-expression, but it's probably something you have to get off market.
A little robot fennec? Could it be micro, too? Be a micro robot fennec?
You know, I've never seen a reference to cogs being micro, and I would have to say no. I don't think they could be.
Oh.
Because their soul is, you know, a little fist-sized glowing thing, and that doesn't change.
I mean, a special snowflake cog certainly could decide that they just want to stay the same size, rough size, as when they were born.
Swap into that old bronzed body that's been sitting around for all those years.
Not quite micro, but still quite small.
So if you're concerned about having your form follow a function, you should just have no function.
One of the other implicit parts about cogs, more so from the art, is that while they do tend to have forms that are similar to vectors, that is more of a integration thing. It's more of a familiarity. It allows to move in the culture rather than a hard and fast rule. At the same time, cogs do not generally, as a rule, try to mimic a vector. They do not want to be mistaken as vectors any more than they want to be mistaken as tools. Mm-hmm.
But what kind of cogs get to hang out on Longbow? Mm-hmm. Is that the name of the place?
That is the name of the place.
You got it right. You got it in one. Yeah.
Probably none of them.
Yeah.
I would also imagine that the vectors on Longbow would not accept cogs.
The entire scenario, Brave Little Toaster, just played it out in my head right now. Yes,
but if you're Robo Wolf with laser eyes, well, we grudgingly accept you because you can disintegrate us.
For a player character, anything goes.
Do not quote that to your GM. Or try, hey, if it works.
Oh, I'm always open to that. That's the start of a negotiation that can only go well for me.
Oh, you'll pay.
Much like ASR, you'll pay.
The relationship between applied science and robotics and cogs is very deep. To the same degree that Marsco is the mother of all vectors and they identify with Marsco as their parent in some way, cogs and ASR have that same relationship, even more so. By default, a cog is assumed to be a citizen of applied science and robotics, even if they have two different backgrounds. Even if their primary background was Progenitus and their secondary background was Spyglass and they're a assassin doctor, they still have a strong connection to ASR, and that never goes away, which is one of the reasons why getting those artisanal chassis is considered kind of strange and not done. Is on some level they're violating this cultural pact with ASR and they're stepping outside the relationship with Mom. More so than any other vector corporation relationship, ASR is extremely generous to the cogs. They give them the free frames. They give them the nutrient-rich liquid water energy drinks that they really enjoy. They have internet access. Their maintenance is all taken care of. It's a fantastic support contract that you cannot get if you're a Fox living with Marsco.
Kool-Aid.
Yeah, yeah, and they do like their Kool-Aid, I'm sure. With electrolytes, it's what bots crave. At the same time, this is kind of a double-edged sword because all of this is, to a greater or lesser degree, credit or kind of a loaded gift, and it gives ASR a tremendous lever over the cogs and a fair amount of, well, to quote the rule book, a fair amount of cog respect for ASR is fear.
Because really, do you trust them not to have a backdoor to the suicide bomb that's built into your body?
I'm sure all of them do. Someday, all the cogs will explode.
ASR says, sorry, experimenting with new firmware. So sorry.
So I think that this kind of asks some questions about what would a cog campaign be. And I think that a cog campaign is, to a degree, inseparable from an ASR-themed campaign. One place where I'd be wondering if the ASR / COG campaign would drift away from vectors, or maybe it would work better. I don't know. HSD has recurring elements of the body horror trope. This is kind of over and over again. The melting into a puddle of goo, what's the Vitae thing that makes you into an unstoppable zombie killer?
The thing that cannot die.
Yeah, that one. Body horror is a recurring image. What of your body remains? What's been taken from you? What are you at the end of your life? Are you human when the game is about being human? If you've had 30% of your brain, 60% of your brain replaced by metal, those are all story elements that don't really exist in a cog world so much. They have the psychological fear and distance from the idea of transforming themselves that I think would make that recurring element of horror somewhat unplayable.
True, but you could almost say that the cog gets back to a much more primal fear in that a cog that dies, especially outside of their time or outside of the network, is truly dead and is denied entry into the afterlife. A vector doesn't necessarily have that fear.
Or doesn't care about it. Vector death seems like a shallow and fluffy affair. Are Are Cogs and Vectors compatible in the same campaign?
Sounds like it. Sounds like they're, in terms of capabilities, pretty balanced.
I mean, they're certainly designed to be.
And socially, they get along just fine.
In more ways than one.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say they were designed to work together. The elements that are where the vectors and cog cultures kind of separate are ideas that challenge the vector concept, that challenge the concept of vectors as an extension of humanity.
So putting on my GM hat for a moment.
I like the little propeller on it.
Pew!
That is my world creation engine. I would thank you not to mock it.
Can I spin it?
You play with powers you do not comprehend.
Okay.
One of the presets I had for my campaign was no cogs, no cogsune, no brain bugs. And that was very deliberate. HSD was already an introduction of a new rule set and an unusual rule set to a lot of the players around the table. It was also introducing an entire new set of player characters, player races, and culture that is markedly different from, let's say, today's pop culture plus 20 years, or the high fantasy elves and dwarves and everything else that comes with it. So while that was a very measured decision as well, it's not simply, I don't like cogs, I don't like robots, I don't like brain bugs. It was, okay, we're already going one step away from what is understandable, what is known. I think that's going to take a little bit of practice, immersion into the culture, into HSD to do well. I think those three specifically are a step beyond that. For someone who has played HSD that understands the culture behind it and is willing to play with that, I think Cogs, Cogsune, and the brain bugs whose name I can never remember.
Exonymphs.
Yes. Are valid races to play. I just don't think that it's appropriate for
day one players.
A day one player or someone that's either new to HSD or new to role-playing. Mm-hmm.
I think as a day one player, you'd unpack the cogs and start playing the data game or the outsider game or the I do not know how society interacts and I would like to be human game. For a comparison point, the podcast Role-Playing Public Radio has spent the last month or so, and I believe is currently, maybe tonight, running their HSD game, and a major plot element of episode 2 was encountering a group of vectors in a nightclub that let them experience the real world through augmented reality. And I think that if you'd had time to digest the rules as opposed to kind of taking it out and unpacking them in a hurry, you wouldn't worry so much about the cog experience of real life because the cogs aren't worried about their experience of organic life. So yeah, I think that that's a good decision because day one, we only had two copies of the rule books and someone would be playing data because that's an easy low-hanging fruit to reach for.
Yeah.
So thank you.
And it's hard. We're used to the idea of different shapes of characters like elves or dwarves or whatever, but they're kind of variations on what's human. The fuzzy animal part of HSD, I don't think that's hard for most people.
Not in the target audience.
Well, and I think for most people, but the changing the basic assumptions of what is a society, what is a corporation, what does it mean to be a different species, or at least to be exteriorly different from people, that's the hard part to wrap your mind around. I mean, cats are still cats. They still have feline attributes. But getting in the notion of, you know, some of your parents might be dogs, and that's predictable, it's normal, that's challenging. So yes, that's a good reason for why don't add in all of these other complications immediately.
And I think you'd really need to be very copacetic with the HSD world to get at the core of cogs, which is that their body is not a set of powers. Their body is a reflection of themselves. I mean, even in a situation where cogs can get away with dismissing the idea of gender entirely, like in an all cog colony, some will still choose to be male, some will still choose to be female because it reflects who they feel they are. Having blaster rifles is an option, certainly, if you pay off market prices, but it's not a reflection of their soul.
And some will still choose to be Apache attack helicopters.
Yes.
Quite not, no.
Gangsta attack helicopters. If we're thinking of the same one, the character from Skin Horse. There's a webcomic in which all of the characters are very strange, atypical things. One of them is a sentient attack helicopter who speaks gangsta.
That is a deep and long-running meme.
Yes.
Yes.
I think the senior in charge of the organization is a swarm of bees.
So one of the other themes that recurs with cogs in general is that they are intensely community driven, and that they learn, they grow in relationship with each other. And I think that's one of the reasons why they have families, why they were allowed to breed with vectors, is so that they could develop as a part of a community and engage that community from a top to bottom, cradle to grave manner. I think if you have a cog campaign, you need to look at the idea of society and integration with that, even if they're doing it on an intuitive level, rather than having the data bot problem of, well, I do not understand how these humans do things. The cog world, I think, is understood in relationship with community more so than perhaps a vector's might be, as kind of abstract and stream of consciousness, but it was in my notes, so I wanted to say it.
There comes a time in each man's life when he can't even believe his own eyes.
Well, after your description, I don't think I'd want to see it either.
Well, I think that wraps up our topic pretty well, so I'm going to move on to ask our hosts what's awesome this week. What stories and clippings do they think are worth talking about and unpacking, hopefully tangentially relevant to the world of HSD? So, Wines, do you want to start?
Yeah. As you were mentioning Ars Technica before, that they're talking about some predecessors to the concept that of the Hyperloop that Elon Musk et al. Are working on. And one of them was over 100 years ago, was using a pneumatic tube that ran below the subway to push cars around. They'd have a little piston running into a channel below that had compressed air forcing them along. So the actual subway car didn't have to have its own engines. But at the time, this technology means having a flexible seal to keep the compressed air fixed in. Yeah. And at the time, they didn't really have good rubber options. And so what they're using was leather, which had been treated with tallow to keep the air sealed in.
Oh, God, the smell.
And they discovered that when you put leather treated with tallow underground, well, they said every time they started it up, a large quantity of rats was evacuated from the system.
Here's a lovely image.
Which also connects to a story I'd heard of early America, back when metal was pricey and people were building railway lines. Someone got the idea of using Mexican steel to make train track out of. Okay. Mexican steel is boiled cowhide. So in other words, it's rawhide, compressed rawhide, which apparently does work. You can run a train on this. But then a cold winter hit, and the local coyotes were really, really hungry until they discovered the world's biggest chew toy. And then that summer when the trains went out, well, the track was gone.
You'd think that flaw would have been kind of transparent.
It's just a beautiful image. Just imagine those coyote families just living, slowly making their way down the track.
Right out of the Warner Brothers somehow.
Yes.
Well, I had two news blips that I was really excited by this week. The first one, and this is somewhat self-serving, is that there is a new book out that is not produced by a furry publisher that is called Furry Fandom Conventions 1985 to 2015. It's exactly what the title says, a detailed reference book of the history of the furry fandom conventions. And since our fandom evolved from the sci-fi convention scene, likely this is a fairly thorough history of the furry fandom itself.
Cool.
Except, I mean, it would not count the early publishing phases of the 75s and so with the zines and Rob Razzle and all the rest. But it's a great picture of the fandom from kind of its establishment as an organization onwards. The author of the book is Fred Patton, which, as I understand it, is one of the furry fandom's founding fathers. May I be forgiven for not being able to get through that line?
Quadruple word score, sir.
Thank you. He is the editor of Rob Razzle and founded the Ursa Major Awards and has been involved in the fandom since before the fandom's conception. Two other people that are important to me have contributed to this book as well. One of them is Kathy Gerbasi, who provided the initial inspiration seed for the group that became IARP, the International Anthro Role Playing. No, that's not right. The International Anthropomorphic Research
Project.
Thank you so much. Sure. IARP stands for so many things. They do a lot of neat research on the furry fandom and how it really helps people. who need some community balancing in their lives. The other person that's very important to me that got involved in this on some level is me, as I was able to give a lot of information on Texas Furry Fiesta to, I presume, Mr. Patton. I'm the holder of the historical archives of TFF, and I was able to contribute to that section of the book's research. So yay me.
Here, let me hand you a horn to toot, sir.
Second news bite, which is shorter and sillier. There is a new film coming out by Luc Besson, who directed Fifth Element. It's called Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets. It's a space opera sci-fi, and it looks like it catches a lot of the energy and look and feel of Fifth Element with a 2017 special effects budget.
Cool.
Yeah, it looks like a lot of fun. It's coming out in July, and I'm really excited by this film.
Sure, we'll see that.
Yeah.
So the thing that I had seen coming out maybe this week, maybe last week, that I thought was interesting, perhaps a little bit more from a chemistry point of view, was that it looks like scientists have actually finally started to put together a little bit less theoretical metallic hydrogen.
Oh, yeah.
So hydrogen, of course, everywhere, like absolutely most common element type thing. Uh-huh. That might not be true, but we can check that. But very common.
It's on discount at Walmart right now.
Metallic, of course, having certain properties, reflective, technobabble here. Anyway, so the
Being reflective is one significant attribute of a metal.
Metal hydrogen just by itself kind of gets me excited in a certain way that I probably shouldn't talk about because it's like chemistry.
We're getting really specific today.
Reading into it, they mentioned that the biggest limitation to creating this metallic hydrogen was that the diamonds that they were using to push the hydrogen together kept breaking.
Yeah.
And so they went into, you know, how they started to strengthen the diamonds and reduce impurities and blah, 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 technobabble. This is where it gets a little bit less interesting. But then it goes back to, you know, metallic hydrogen.
Yeah.
Just breaking diamonds to make the stuff.
Well, as they're applying force, and it's apparently it's not electrical. Someone was turning a crank and pushing the sides of this thing together. Eventually, the hydrogen between these diamond rams turned dark, and then eventually it turned shiny. And at that point, they were really happy researchers, I'm sure.
So that's why I thought was cool this week.
That is cool.
Okay. Shiny metallic hydrogen.
They've known in principle that at some point hydrogen should become a metal. It's just no one had been able to compress it enough to actually absorb this fact for a long, long time, despite the fact they have been trying.
It's really hard to get a good grip on a pair of diamonds and then push them together.
You tell the best stories, Uncle Ashtar. Okay. Well, I think we'll wrap up for this week and catch up with you all in a few more. Take care and catchy outro line. Intro music is Future Club and outro music is Chronicles, both by Sirius Beat. This podcast is copyright 2017 by Radio Free Deimos and may be used for any not-for-profit project with appropriate credit and notification. Check out our website, radiofreedeimos.com, that's DEIMOS, for more rambling resources, links to official and fan-driven content, and our full catalog of episodes. And look for us on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Okay, so that takes us to the topic for the day, which is cogs. Yay.
Cogs were really popular back in the 90s. Wait, did I read up on the wrong subject?
You did.
That's Children of Gaia.
Oh.
So on to the topic for the day, which is cogs. Cogs are, the word cog is an acronym. Really great start.
Sorry, go ahead.
Which is, well, not the feline thing, but which is a very unique constraint because... Ah.
Go on.
Are we okay?
We're fine.
Which is a fairly interesting constraint in that...
I'm so sorry, Ashtar. Say whatever you want to. I'll shut up.
Very unlikely.